This is The 11th Hour. I'm Páraic Branach. Welcome to this week's selection from The 11th Hour podcast. Tonight, a special programme on the writer Molly Keane, as a book of centenary essays which examines the woman in her work was recently published.
You've got to make your own world. Even if you're terribly happily, if your children are married and so on, miserable, your husband is dead, but this was a long time ago, but still you'll be useless to your friends, you'll be, you know, boring to the last if you didn't have a world of your own.
In the studio, Avery Welch, lecturer at the Department of Modern English, UCC, co-editor of the book. Gwenda Young, lecturer in Film Studies, UCC, co-editor of the book. Tom McCarthy, Waterford-born, Cork-based poet who knew and admired Molly Keane greatly. And Sally Phipps, Molly's daughter, who is currently working on a book about her mother. Now we hear the voice of Molly Keane from an interview conducted in 1984 with Cayman Jones.
Are you pleased that your earlier novels, four of your earlier novels, are about to be published?
Yes, I'm jolly pleased. It's a nice little financial help, as well as everything else. I never think anything of my books, but thank God somebody thinks enough of them to spend money on them.
Well, can I ask you a dreadful question? Are you making lots and pots of money with all the royalties coming in from TV and books and so on at the moment?
Well, I'm well off the breadline, thank God. And also a great deal of my sustenance comes from that wonderful Eoghan Donnelly. Eoghan Donnelly is Ireland's treasures, you know. I'm one of Ireland's treasures, believe it or not.
Indeed you are. Indeed you are.
No, but it is the Irish. It was for the minstrels and people, you know, and the poets who went around. They were called Eoghan Donnelly, Ireland's treasures. So it was rather a nice, flattering name for all us old lags who are in Eoghan Donnelly.
Molly Keane, the Irish big house novelist, was born Molly Screen in County Kildare in 1904. She published a series of books and plays under the pseudonym M.J. Farrell, as a protection perhaps from the anti-intellectual world of the Anglo-Irish class system. She later wrote plays with London Stage in association with Sir John Gielgud, and her latter years wrote as Molly Keane, finding perhaps her true voice and a Booker Prize nomination into the bargain. She died in 1996. In 2004, UCC hosted a centenary conference in her honour, and from this event, Molly Keane Centenary Essays is published by Four Courts Press. Ava Welch, as co-editor of this centenary essays, was Molly Keane a national treasure?
Yes, I think she was, and I think she is. I think it's great that her novels continue to be in print. Good Behaviour has always been there, her best novel. But her wonderful early novels, written under the name of M.J. Farrell, have just all been reissued. And it's, for me as a teacher of modern Irish fiction, it's wonderful that my students can read such treasures as Devoted Ladies and 2 Days in Aragon and Time After Time. So I think she was and is a national treasure because I think she's just so readable.
What is the particular interest? Is it just the accessibility?
Yes, she is very accessible. She's very funny. She's quite dark. She writes of a sort of vanished world, but my theory on her has always been that when she wrote her great novel, Good Behaviour, at the end, it seemed of one writing career, but the beginning of another, she'd lived long enough that she could actually take on the whole system that she'd grown up in and deconstruct it, subvert it, and make wonderful comedy out of it. That's why she's such an interesting figure. And that's why I think my students certainly continue to connect with her work.
That's the essential connection with your students, the deconstruction of an age-old system, the Anglo-Irish ascendancy.
I think it's because she gets such wonderful comedy and observation out of it. And I think they respond to comedy, a well-written story, and the kind of energy that she brings to her novels. I notice that they sail through them when they want to read them.
Where did you discover Molly Keane's work first? What era of your life?
I read when I was quite young. I read Time After Time, which is a very chilling novel. It's a great novel, but I think it's her most serious novel, and it's her novel about old age. And it began, I think, for me, that interest in her work. I then went to Good Behaviour, and I admire it greatly. And then I started reading the M.J. Farrell novels, thinking, oh, well, you know, these are earlier works, maybe they're not so interesting. I think they are. I mean, I think they're big house novels. There's her Devoted Ladies is a sort of lesbian novel. There's all sorts of wonderful themes in her early work as well.
Gwendolyn Young, co-editor of the book. What's the attraction of Molly Keane for you?
Much of what Ava says holds true for me as well. I read Good Behaviour in college, and I suppose I didn't read much more of her work until I had the pleasure of meeting her daughters, and then I started reading the later novels, Time After Time and Loving and Giving. And then once we decided to organise this conference, I went back into reading the early novels. And as Ava says, I was really attracted to their black humour and their subversiveness. And I think it's something that she has all the way through her writing career, this dark humour and this sense, both within the big novel genre, that she's kind of deconstructing it even from her novels, and it becomes more prominent, it becomes more prevalent, this deconstruction and this subversiveness in the ones that she published in her kind of comeback era. And I find Good Behaviour, I think it was a novel that it just stayed with me, because it's a devastating novel. I just found it kind of chilling to some extent, and really uncomfortable to read, and hilariously funny and very wicked, but it made me feel uncomfortable as a reader, and I think that's a good thing.
Here we have an archive clip of Molly Keane talking about her novel Time After Time and Life in the Big House.
It's about age. It's about old people who never grow old, who never outgrow any of their faults or see where they've gone wrong. And that's my, more or less my theme, that people don't change. You're that when you're a child. That happens to you when you're a child, and you remain the same person when you're 70.
I thought it was a sad book.
Did you?
Yes.
Oh, I thought it was a funny book.
I thought it was funny in parts, but I thought essentially it was sad.
Yes, I suppose it was, really. Decay
these
is always
sad.
These
three sisters and the brother just living out their last years in this great big crumbling house.
Yes, but they weren't... They were used to the crumbling house. They'd been born in it. They'd always lived in it. You know, and that makes an extraordinary sort of difference to how you feel about a house. And they all had that sort of occupations and preoccupations. They had
their little
worlds. They thought, yes, but not to them little. They were their worlds. Not little, but world. And I think that people do live like that very much. If you don't make a world, you're lost. I mean, after all, you've got to make your own world. Even if you're terribly happily, that your children are married and so on, and miserable, your husband is dead, but this was a long time ago. But still, you'll be useless to your friends. You'll be, you know, boring to the last if you didn't have a world of your own. Everybody makes a world of their own.
Tom McCarthy, you give the keynote address at the 2004 conference, but you also gave the oration at the funeral. What was Molly Keane to you?
Well, she was first and foremost really a great writer, a fastidious, careful writer, who really understood about life, I think. I mean, I knew her before she published Good Behaviour, which was the great comeback LP, if you like. Before that, I knew her as a great reader of books. I remember her giving me books in Capoquin, like she, when I was 13 or 14, meeting her, and I know, maybe 15, and she said, "You must read Proust." You know, I hadn't a clue what Proust was. And she handed me the Gourmand's Way, you know, the early La Recherche du Temps Perdu of Proust, and like it was just she was shoving experiences into you if she thought you were interested. And it's very interesting to hear her voice, which is so real, the enthusiasm, and also in her voice the certainty that you have to have a world of your own, you must create that world and in many ways hold on to it. And I think what is fascinating about her is that she held on to the same world. She may have been its interrogator, and you could say a very critical eye cast on that world, but it was her world, you know, and she was completely confident about the promise of life within that world, you know. To misuse a phrase, I suppose, that an auctioneer might use in another context, it was a world that was etiquette rich and cash poor. That's why Ace Donna was so important to somebody like her, you know, because it was a safety net financially. It was a world of manners and of fine things, you know.
Sally, you were part of that world with her daughter. How would you describe that world?
I was part of the last part, as it were, because she lived in her world with belief and rejoicing, despite being ironically aware of its decline and its cruelties. And at the same time, she she sort of chronicled its decline. I suppose I was more aware of its decline than as a person than she was.
She was still romantically attached to it?
Yes, especially to the houses.
And the architecture and the decor.
Yes, and she was a great lover of the Irish landscape and described it extraordinarily, I think. She was a very painterly writer. I think the natural world affected her, fed into her books in both overt and hidden ways.
I find that fascinating, Eva, the English-Irish ascendancy, even after, as in Molly's case, her father's house was burnt out. Mm-hmm. They still wanted to live in Ireland. They still loved Ireland.
Oh, yes.
What was that?
Well, I think Tom and Sally explained, I think, beautifully. It was so much her world. And what holds you from her as a novelist from beginning to end, from the first novel to the right at the end of her life that she's writing, is it's a completely realised world. I know nothing of that world, and I understand everything of it. I think she's subversive, but I also think you couldn't write about such a world without relishing it, and in the way that Tom and Sally have described. I love the fact that she was a writer in a world where there was, I think, perhaps not a value on writing, yet she found that her material. I mean, in some ways, I'd go as far as to say maybe the Philistinism of her world that she loved to describe, though as Tom has told us, she was herself a woman of great literary interest, and you couldn't write like this without having read as she did. Can I read a piece?
What?
Which is a piece about...
Be my guest.
Her, well, it's just, I love this, because only a writer could observe this distrust of books amongst... Well, this is, I have to point out, not an Anglo-Irish mother and father, but an English mother and father, whose son has been reading poetry. Nanny discovers this.
Oh, that's an awful crime.
It's not good. And he's lied about the book. He said he was reading Robinson Crusoe, but he wasn't. And so she tells us, Nanny took the book straight to Lady Grizel, who talked it over unhappily with the captain. His response was generally worried. Yes, we shall have to put a stop to this bookworming. No future in that. And he was having a music lesson today when old Sholto was schooling his pony. His wife replies, that's hardly the point, isn't it? The awful things he told me, quite a big fib. Her husband responds, well, that's more natural. It's this poetry that bothers me. What's the book called? Children's Golden Treasury of Verse, she says. Unhealthy sounding stuff.
But Tom, the big house, as a form of literature, is an anachronism.
Not really, because even to take up the narrative of the Anglo-Irish is in a way a kind of stylistic decision. I mean, one of the primary acts, I think, in any person who is either a painter or a writer is the limitation of subject matter, so that you can focus more sharply on what it is you wish to record. And I think Molly Keane, you know, did that focusing so brilliantly. It's interesting that you could say she was part of a very artistic generation or parish of rich women, which might have included Nora McGuinness and all of these painters who were such painterly painters as well, you know, and yet such modernists in the mid-20th century. And Molly, I always think, is a sort of an intellectual equal of these painters within the realm of words, you know. The thing about Molly as well is that she loved society. It's just impossible to emphasise how much she loved company and loved society. She loved eating, she loved food, she loved cooking, she loved drinking with friends. I mean, she just loved society. I remember even after I shouldn't have, but I knew that she'd come out of hospital when she was, I suppose, 90 probably, and an American academic had gotten in contact with me and said, do you know Molly Keane? And I said, of course I do. John Bernstein from Macalester College in America. And John was teaching two of her novels. And he said, you know, I just love to meet her. And I said, well, she's not really well, but I will ring her and see, but I wouldn't hold out any hopes. And so when I rang her, he said, oh, he must come. So, I mean, she put on a lavish sort of party for him, and she'd also invited Herd Hatfield, the actor, you know, who's so famous for the Dorian Gray picture, but also for The Left-Handed Gun, which my friend from America mentioned. And, of course, Herd was delighted that he was remembered for The Left-Handed Gun, and Molly was thrilled that now Herd was happy. And so it was an incredible party, you know, of terrific food and beautiful drink, cocktails and wine and everything, just put on for the sake of a friend who was just passing through Ardmore. And that was... She was 90 then. And I mean, it was just so typical of Molly, you know, of enjoying meeting people. I do remember those incredible years because, like, almost on a weekly basis, I remember the successes as they fell to her after the publication of Good Behaviour. And things like, it was published earlier, I think a few months earlier in America in 81, and Molly got a beautiful letter from somebody like Eudora Welty saying how beautiful the novel was. And that in itself was a kind of reconnection for Molly and a kind of victory that there were people out there waiting for her new fiction. The last years of her life were so triumphant. They were magical, you know.
She certainly enjoyed the notice and the attention she got from, in the latter years of her life, in her second reincarnation, the man might say. But did she enjoy writing, Sally?
Well, she always said she'd never wish it on anyone. She was very distressed when it began to unravel in old age. She said she only wrote for money and that she'd much rather have been a housewife than a writer because she loved domesticity so much, but that it didn't pay so well. But I think it was absolutely part of her and she did love it secretly, although she found writing very painful and difficult, but I think most writers do.
But she had two sort of phases of the writer. She wrote in her first novel when she was 17, recuperating from illness from Mills and Boone, and then she had a career as M.J. Farrell, a pseudonym which she adopted. Why?
Well, she said she saw it out hunting.
In a pub,
at a crossroads. Yeah. But I think it's an interesting name because, first of all, you assume it's a man. Mm. And secondly, Farrell is not an Anglo-Irish name necessarily. Mm. It's gender neutral. And when Sally was talking there, I was interested about the idea that, you know, she much preferred not to have been a writer and she found it onerous, as all writers do. But was it a protection within her own class? And I know she knew Elizabeth Bowen. And of course, her own mother had been a writer.
Yes.
But I did wonder, was it how comfortable was she as a younger woman with the idea of the public role of the writer?
I don't think she considered really the public role, but she thought nobody would dance with her at hunt balls if they knew she was a writer.
Because she would be therefore an intellectual or...
Or somebody who... And of course, as she wrote entirely out of the world around her, they would feel she was sort of like a spy, perhaps. Mm.
Which, of course, every good writer is.
Yes.
Was there a sense that her books published under M.J. Farrell, were they read by her friends? Were they discussed with her?
Eventually they were. Of course, writing in those days was so different. It didn't receive the publicity it does today, and you didn't have to... You didn't have to sell your books. Yeah. It was a much more private concern, wasn't it? And people either bought them or they didn't.
But the secret got out. Her friends found out she was M.J. Farrell.
Yes, they did about three books on. Mm. She had a very gossipy friend she was very fond of, Daphne Haldare. And she told her, and of course by then, after that, everyone knew.
Word got out.
But also she felt her mother, who was a poet and who was a very Victorian person, wouldn't approve of her writing.
I was thinking about that. Her mother mightn't approve of the mothers in her novel.
Yeah,
I mean, they're so
extraordinary portraits of mothers.
And they're her best, amongst her best, are either adolescents. Well, I mean, she is such a range, but we think of a mother, the woman in Full House or The Rising Tide. Or, of course, Mummy in Good Behaviour.
Were they modelled on your mother, on her mother's side?
No, they were very unlike her. Her own mother, she was very reclusive and they were rather social and grand, weren't they? But they were like grand screen chatelaines around Bath who the children used to stay with, and they always felt like poor Irish relations, in these grand English cousins, with these grand English cousins and these wonderful architect houses and...
But it is amazing that her mother was Moira O'Neill, you see, who wrote The Songs of the Glens of Antrim, published in 1916.
That is fascinating.
You know, I mean, it's just an entirely hidden background and a rejected background. It's interesting that one would reject a poet as a mother or a mother poet in order to be a novelist of Anglo-Irish society. You know, if you think of the fiction of Moira O'Neill and the fiction of The Songs of the Glens of Antrim, which are, in a way, ballads of the pure Gael, if you like, or whatever, of the Scottish as well. Molly Keane, in a way, first of all, almost deconstructed her mother before she became a writer herself, you know. So in many ways, the complexity, the social complexity of Molly's own social interests were in many ways a rejection of the Puritanism of her mother's yes. songs of the Glens of Antrim. I think it's,
but there was a long tradition, Eva, of the ascendancy, like Douglas de Heger, the first Bible in Irish was run by Protestants.
Indeed, and the important Anglo-Irish novelists, including her friend Elizabeth Bowen, Sumvan Ross, Mariah Edgeworth, George Moore. And I come back to the argument that because she makes her world so isolated, by the time of Good Behaviour, there's no social background. It's the house and nothing else. Mm. In 2 days in Aragon, you have the War of Independence, the IRA, British officers. When you're getting to the later novels, it's almost Beckettian. You have this pure universe. And in that universe, she took on, I think, and I argue, dismantles the very tradition. Because Sumvan Ross write about those worlds in very admiring, broad social ways. Mm. So as Tom is saying, not only is she perhaps reconstructing her own mother's work, I always think of her as perhaps her mother was Speranza to her Oscar. I don't know, but there was a way in which she needed to move into this into the drawing room.
Was she the last of the Fianna, or Tom, the last of the Anglo-Irish ascendancy to write about it?
Definitely not. I don't know who the next person is, but I'm certain that there will be another Anglo-Irish. It probably will be somebody who will have, you know, shared the drawing room of J.P. McManus and his grand house in County Limerick, because remember, Ireland and the Irish gentry constantly renew themselves with new blood. We can see it ourselves in the more famous and wealthy people who are buying Anglo-Irish houses now and even building them to their own specifications. you can see, and they are the Speaker Connollys
of
the present era.
The interesting thing about livestock in Ireland over the last 10 years, the only livestock that has been a huge increase in is horses. That may point out something. Going back to the writings of Molly King, Devoted Ladies was quite a controversial novel. Here is Molly King herself talking about that novel.
Sophisticated ladies who come to Ireland and how their whole life gets unravelled and turned back into normal life, as it were.
It's about very close friendship between women.
Two women, that they are the only close friendships in the book. The others are normal as gooseberry pie.
Well, I think you thought the book would raise something of a stir at the time it was published because of the lesbian theme.
Well, I don't think it did strike me, because I think everybody had sort of suddenly started slightly more thinking about that and not keeping it quite under curtains like it used to be. After all, there had been several sort of staggering great books about that theme, about the lesbian theme. What about The Well of Loneliness? I mean, my book isn't at least like that. It's a sort of joke book.
What prompted you to write it? Well, at what stage of your life were you when you decided to write Devoted Ladies?
I suppose I was about 29, that sort of. About 29, because I'd written quite a few books.
I mean, did you want to be daring at that stage?
I wanted to find something to write about. I was always looking for something to write about, you know. And I thought that was very funny. Like, I always think things are black funny. And then, you know, people don't think they're quite so funny. I just suddenly met this lady who came to stay in the house where I was staying, and who arrived with 1,000 cigarettes and a safety razor, no other luggage. And that set me thinking, now, what a funny idea.
What a funny idea.
Yeah, indeed. It's a remarkable novel, published in 1934, and remarkably modern in its depiction of these lesbian ladies. It's quite overt about it, that these two lovers come back to Ireland, and their story then is played out against a backdrop of the big house and other female companions whose stories kind of echo the two English ladies. But it was published in 1934, and it is remarkable because, unlike other novels which were more perhaps overtly being read in a kind of a lesbian fashion, such as Mary Lavelle, it wasn't banned. Molly Keane seems to have gotten away with a lot of stuff, both in this novel and in other novels. I mean, gay characters come up all the time in her novels. And I think we were just talking before we came in that she seems to have been interested in the theme of homosexuality and lesbianism. And she saw it as a theme, I think. that it was an interesting thing to put into her books. And it, of course, she was very familiar with the scene in London because of her friendships with John Gielgud and John Perry, and she was working in the theatre there. So it wasn't, you know, it shows how sophisticated she was in the 30s, and that she saw a world outside of the Anglo-Irish world.
It also shows how clever she was a writer not to get banned ever.
It's interesting, as Gwenda was saying, Mary Lavelle gets banned in 36 and by Kate O'Brien, and then in 1941 The Land of Spices gets banned for one sentence. I think Kate O'Brien put in those sentences to almost test the censor. Kate O'Brien was writing about Catholic middle-class protagonists. Molly Keane was writing about English and some Anglo-Irish and in comedies and theatrical people, whereas Kate O'Brien was talking about practicing, believing Catholics from nice homes in Melwick and other provincial places.
The Big House people, Tom, were supposed to be decadent, was that it?
Yeah, I think so.
I think that it was a kind of, that was the way to get away with immorality. If it was Protestant, it was all right. Because it wasn't really immorality at all. It was just an entirely different ethical sort of world, you know. It was a self-contained, a kind of hermetic world, which in a way didn't challenge any of our perceptions about ourselves, because it is a kind of card trick, really. It's sort of, the cards are played, but they're not our game. So therefore, we can't take offence in any way. And I think that Molly understood that, really, when she was talking about things that were funny and humorous. She could also be quite cutting. But she knew that as a writer, her duties were to what she knew, you know. In many ways, a writer's duty is to basically to their own class, you know, to interrogate that class, because everything else is a form of voyeurism. And she did that so brilliantly. But yet, at the same time, she was describing, making, I think, incredibly good poetry and prose, you know, out of interiors. And that's part of the kind of living gift of her books, you know.
But Sally, she did describe decadence and decay and immorality very well.
Yes. She had a very dark side to her imagination and a very poetic one. And I think that worked very well for her as a writer. But I think why she suddenly wrote about the homosexual world, well, she suddenly had great friends in it. And she always loved homosexual people in every way except sexually. She was drawn to that world because of the wonderful style and honed language and the fact that there was a troubled background, as her own was troubled, that it was a wonderful liberation for her, meeting John Perry and his friends.
There'd be a certain shared alienation. She would have been alienated in her own class, and homosexuals would be alienated in society.
Yes, although I think mostly it was a sympathy, a feeling of really meeting people who she could get on with, and people who loved domesticity. John loved domesticity, jokes, and gossip and talk, and you know, I think it was a wonderful liberation for her and an enormous opening up of her world when she entered that world, really. And she entered it at Woodruff, which was this wonderful house in Tipperary where John Perry came from, and it was a marvellous sort of bohemian place, very different from her own more Victorian background, very, very liberated, really. And everybody went there, and it was based on the horse, of course. And therefore, it was kind of familiar to her. She became tremendously close to John Perry's mother and father, and people who came to stay there from all over the artistic world. It was our first experience of the artistic world, really. And John had left his background and become totally theatrical in London, but he loved hunting, and he was like a visitor to his own world, you know. And
But she did the same herself. She went away to London and then lived the life in London, West End successes, and then there was 1961 or whatever, there was a play that didn't go so well, and then there was let's go back to Ireland and let's stop writing. What precipitated that change, Eva?
I often wondered about that, and I know Sally has written about it, and that and Tom has written and talked about it as well, that sense of change. I think, as Sally's describing, she needed the theatrical world and the difference, I think, to learn her craft.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because an awful lot of this is crafted social comedy, as I'm sure her plays were. So she needed to go back, but to go out into this other world, and I think the wit that Sally is talking about in the kind of London gay world must have given her the kind of great comedy that she has. But then she goes back to Ireland for her subjects, as Tom was saying, and she goes back to what she knew. So she's probably living, I suspect, artistically. I mean, London's the place where she's being published, London's the place where her plays are being produced. And then, I suppose, fashion changed, and she must have had a very strong sense that, well, I'm of an era. I'm a writer of the 20s, 30s, 40s. John Osborne, Pinter, Angry Young Men, Beckett, indeed, as we've talked about. And there is this silence and this sense that maybe she felt that she'd lost her space, her relevance, I suppose, to use that word.
Or market, even.
All of those things.
She wrote this play, Dazzling Prospect, that got really panned by the critics. Mm. It was just the beginning of the new theatre that you describe. Mm. And also it wasn't a good play. Mm. And it made her feel that she had nothing more to say.
Mm. Mm. It must have been very difficult for a woman who'd been writing from 17, published from her early 20s, and a successful commercial dramatist and playwright.
But she said herself, I never thought anything of my books. She must have thought greatly of her play that she was so upset about it.
Well, I think that sort of criticism would unhinge any writer. Mm.
There is actually, there's an entry in Noel Coward's diaries because he attended the first night. I remember reading the Noel Coward's descriptions of both the night and the newspapers in the morning after the play. You know, and he was saying it's a disaster. And he was saying he was really sorry for John Gielgud. But I think that it's one of the practical aspects of the Anglo-Irish as well, in that there's an incredible sense of common sense about them. She felt that, you know, look back in anger, John Osborne, a new kind of working class milieu had come into the theatre and was going to dominate the theatre. And in a way, herself and people like Terence Rattigan and the theatre of the upper class really was receding and would recede. In a way, the market, in other words, the market had changed. And in a way, almost it was something Anglo-Irish and practical about her. She felt the market had left her what she produced, and so she wasn't going to do it anymore.
I could imagine what Kenneth Tynan would have made of her plays. Because
that's right, he wrote a terrible review of that particular play.
Because it's exactly what he was fighting against.
Absolutely.
And he was making new space. I just think her story has this miracle. She goes away, she stops writing, and she could have said to herself, that's it, I've had a very good career.
Yeah, but what got her back writing again 20 years later? This is the question.
Well, she wrote in secret, she wrote Good Behaviour, and she sent it to Billy Collins, her publisher of most of her books, and he thought it was too black and all the characters were too horrible. And he said he just couldn't touch it unless she changed it a bit, and she for once decided she wouldn't change it, and she just left it alone and sort of put it in a drawer. And then her friend Peggy Ashcroft read it and liked it enormously and said, you must do more with it. And it was turned down by a lot of publishers. And finally it came to Gina Pollinger, who's a wonderful agent and was marvellous for Mum's second career. She really loved her work and took enormous care of her writers, and I think she gave her a new confidence. And it was published then by André Deutsch and had these amazingly good reviews and new readers, and other writers spoke to her so well of it, and it was a whole new beginning, really.
But do you remember, it's almost like the apocryphal story of how it was originally accepted, that do you remember her story that it was on Gina Pollinger's desk in London, and an editor from Knopf in New York was visiting London and was looking for a few novels and was one short or something, and Gina Pollinger said, why didn't you try this?
I'd forgotten that.
Yes, and so the agent read it on the plane back to New York and rang Gina Pollinger from JFK and said, we definitely will have this. So it was actually published by Knopf in the United States first.
It was just same time as André Deutsch,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, was it?
Just start to one novel. You meant your man or the publisher.
Yeah. And that is just the way things happen.
But tremendously lucky, but there was a certain perseverance there in holding on to it, not changing it, and presenting it for publishing on a regular basis.
Yes, because she was a great one for changing things, and with her plays she was always adapting them for what the director wanted and so on, and she just decided she wouldn't interfere with good behaviour.
Do you think she knew instinctively that this was it, that she had... This is, I think it's her best novel.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
And she knew that. She knew she'd been writing for so long. She understood her work. That this
she was doing something.
So right.
Yes, yes. Although I think Loving and Giving.
Loving and Giving, I think, is it's more it's lyrical and I suppose maybe more positive almost in a sense, you know, even though somebody falls through a floor at the end of it. But
in a good way, yes.
But Good Behaviour is definitely the darkest because Arun is a terrible character,
it is,
and she ends up almost, she's going to become her mother because she's cruelly taken away the house from the cousins, the poor cousins who are sent to live in a nursing home, and she kills her mama by giving her rabbit moose disguised as chicken and causes the death of her mother. And there's something really black at the end of Good Behaviour. Yes. There's a real sense that Arun has become as cruel, as powerful, as trying to constantly keep power as her mother. And that's something that, you know, you felt sympathy for all the way through the novel because...
She was having such a terrible time.
It's a nightmare the way she was brought up and the cruelty
of
her mother.
And
so unloved and so unwanted. I mean, there's one part of the novel where her mother talks about the costs of doctor's bills and even her birth cost me £10 and nothing is worth that. So there's that real sense from the start that she was an unloved lump of a child.
But I think it was the first time she'd used an unreliable narrator, wasn't it? Mm.
And what did you ever talk to your mum about Arun, what she thought of Arun? Did she feel sympathy for her? Did she feel very mixed feelings towards her?
I think mixed feelings. Yeah. And of course, many people thought they were Arun, you know, many of Mum's friends.
Yeah. That was always a discussion in kind of Capoquin, Ardmore, Lismore,
who's who,
Dungarvan.
Even in Carlo.
Who was who?
So who's the favourite? Was there anyone?
Well, not really.
A variety, I'm sure. She drew on various, I presume it was on various.
Well, one person whose name I won't mention did give out about Time After Time.
Yes.
You know, and said that, I may be an insufferable bore, but I'm not a kleptomaniac.
Yes. Well, you know, she said, when she was asked if she put friends into novels, she said, there's a touch of the Judas in every writer, but it better go mixed with a lot of invention. And that is true, because friendship was so important to her, because so much of her life was spent alone, and she cherished her friends.
Did she put herself in the novels?
Well, yes, I think so.
Yeah, I think you were saying Full House, is it, that she's Eliza?
Yes, and I always feel that Eliza is the closest to a self-portrait. Right.
In Full House?
Yes, at the time.
Yeah.
At the time, you know, she was an artist, an outsider and an insider, somebody who understood the inner world but only spoke of it obliquely in accordance with good behaviour and was a real giver. Although she sort of practiced what seemed like trivial drawing room skills on the surface. I think she's a very interesting character.
We'll probably keep chatting on here another while, but we have to leave you, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight's programme was produced by Art McCarthy, researched by Susan O'Loughlin, Aidan Cunningham was in sound. I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the 11th Hour podcast. The 11th Hour is live on RT Radio 1, Mondays to Fridays at 11 p.m. From me, Páraic Branach, and the rest of the team in the 11th Hour, Slán.